I would like to introduce Dame Helen. Now, I can't resist because I've never had the privilege of introducing a lady with the type of lady. Helen now has got a fascinating background. It combines work, for instance, for the Audit Commission, but also work as Chief Executive of the British Lung Foundation. So very much a patient view again. I'm sure that Helen will give us more food for thought. Thank you very much.
I'll try.
So if you want, just, yeah.
Hello, everybody. I'm not very good at being academic, so forgive me for kind of being practical and basic on my way through this, because it's where I feel the most comfortable. And I'm learning new words this afternoon as a result of listening to some of these lectures. So I'm starting to feel like the patient that doesn't understand medical language, you know, on the way through this. And when Matt very kindly asked me to do this at rather last minute, I have to say, I haven't had very much time to think about it. So when he gave me these five questions, I couldn't quite believe it, because the thought that in 20 minutes you could tackle even one of them became kind of almost ridiculous. But anyway, what I wanted to do was to start off by saying that in general, very few of you here would fit in this category, but anybody over 60 is totally obsessed by health. It's all they talk about, it's all they want to talk about, and it's very boring a lot of the time. So one needs to sort of know, but it's not going away, because at that point they're starting to think that it might be them, as opposed to thinking it won't be me, on the way that sort of takes you up to there. And in a way, what I shall have to do is to kind of caricature some things in order to make the points on the way that I'm trying to do. But if I can start off by saying that if you think that most people's exposure to understanding about health is watching the television, what do you think that they really come away with thinking? Is that everything is like Casualty or ER or one of the other programs that are there? So that everybody is covered in blood, there's constant crises going on, everybody is terribly caring, very few people will die. And the reality, of course, on the programme, if you really watch it, which I'm delighted to say I no longer do, is that actually the healthcare professionals are so obsessed by their personal lives that actually treating the sort of patient is a kind of sideways action to the entire thing. So I think people are drawing quite the wrong messages for that. And as a result, what they do is have a very weird view of what healthcare professionals are and what the health service will provide, which is totally unrealistic. So if I'm trying to look at what Matt's five questions, I just thought you could read through these yourselves, because those are the first three. They don't even fit on a slide. Okay. And then the next two were those. And they were very long questions, weren't they? You know, I'm not very good at long questions, so I decided that really the thing to do was maybe to pick up some of this on the way through and have a bit of a punt at three of them, but I don't know that in the time scale that I'll get through that much. So if I'm looking at the first ones, you know, do you think technological solutions lead to better health and well-being? Well, you know, the quick answer to that is yes and no, and some do and some don't, and some could. Okay, so that kind of could deal with that one, but it's a bit kind of overbrief, so I might expand just a trifle to kind of give a little bit more of a feeling of what might be the thing. So I thought, well, one of the ones that I thought could, and if we're looking at innovation, my goodness me, it's been around long enough, but it isn't yet there, is the whole issue of electronic patient records. And everybody in the room groans, you know, because goodness, haven't we all been saying this? I was thinking back, and I think the first time I raised this with a woman called Gisela Stewart, who most of you will never have heard of, in 1999. And she got very keen on the idea, but got slaughtered because she didn't protect Tony Blair outside a hospital where somebody shouted at him about the cancer treatment of her husband. So her political life disappeared. You know, because that is the vagaries of ministerial life, is if you don't do the right thing, you can't see anything through. And if you think about electronic patient records, it is absolutely ridiculous that we aren't using these systematically throughout the place. And so they could be a vital tool, they could save lives, they could empower people, they could even inform medical professionals talking between themselves, they could increase understanding, but at the moment prevarication is the name of the game. And it's all being done in the name of data protection, which I always think is fascinating, because you've only got to ask the patient whether they'd like to do this, and if they say yes, you can get around any data protection issues that there are, but nobody asks you. So they're a useful screen for doing anything. And there was, before the days of Gisela Stuart, for those of you who've ever been involved in this as long as I have, there was a great experiment amongst the traveller population, because they wanted to prove that if you gave people their own health records, you would in fact lose them, and therefore it would be a disaster. So they gave them to the traveller population to prove, because their short-term mindset of this was that this was a feckless group of people, therefore they were bound to fail. You know, if you set off not wanting something to succeed, you choose the group of people who are most likely to fail. This is the sort of skill of doing things in central policy making that can happen to make you go your right way, or their right way, let me put it like that. I'd like to make it clear that is not how I view that population. However, they were rather stumped by the fact that at the end of the experiment, which lasted in excess of a year, absolutely no health record was ever lost by anybody in the traveller community, but it did in fact mean they got improved health care, because somebody actually had some records to be able to deal with if they were ever ill, which they'd never had before, because if you move around, nobody's got any. So the fact that the experiment worked merely got buried, because nobody really wanted to do this. Because then the next part of innovation is, if you've got a good idea that you think will succeed, then you have to start coming up with the fact that one technical solution compared with another, and who's going to have which one, and how's this going to work, and who's going to pay for it, and all these different things start happening. So I thought that was one that was pretty basic. These get more basic as they go on, but I thought that was pretty basic, and I certainly enjoyed looking at a recent one, which was on called Patient Knows Best. Well, you know, you had sort of very straightforward things, like if you went for a test, the person who'd done the test put the result on there, your GP could see it, you could see it. Nobody could change what anybody else wrote. And I asked what it would cost to put this in for a whole hospital, and somebody told me about 30,000. Well, that didn't feel like a massive amount of money for the kind of return that you might get from that. So then if we start looking at technology, the idea nowadays is that there's an app for everything, isn't there? You know, and you all sit there on your mobile phones. We were hearing that the mobile phone is now more important than a home. So if you've got an app that tells you about everything, or you can test yourself out on it, this should answer everything. Well, in my experience, it doesn't work quite like that. I think for a start, and I was very struck by this, by one of our audience who's left early, who I was trying really hard to walk round in the street as he was looking at the map of the university on his app to try and get here, and did what everybody does when they're looking at their phones in the street, which is walk slower but somehow get wider. It's very strange. I don't know how it comes about, but they're always in the middle of something with something. Anyway, so I managed to skirt round him, only to find, to my amusement, he was coming here. And it had taken him longer with the app than me just walking through the door and looking for signs, you know. So it is quite interesting what they're used for. And of course, if you are using them in the street, the chances are you might be knocked over or be infuriating somebody, so you might end up using healthcare systems rather than being cured by them. And what I'm told is that people use them to start with, but they don't sustain that use of them, unless something's coming back to them the whole time. So it's got to be an interactive process. I don't know that there's been much research on whether they've been any use and whether they really do help to do anything. But I was very struck by listening, whilst driving my car yesterday, to Bruce Keogh speaking on the Today programme. He's the medical director of the NHS. And he was admitting the fact that there were 1 million more people using A&E now than have been in the past. And what was fascinating to me in your first talk, David, was why people are and, you know, where are the numbers in all of this? But are people now being driven to going into using A&E because they're using the web or apps? And they're bypassing, therefore, the fundamental system. So I thought that was an interesting thought. Then, of course, there's the whole issue of telehealth, which I don't know how many different companies have designed pieces of equipment for this, how many different pilots and different schemes there are going on. Basically, in my view, coming from the respiratory world background, they are an extremely useful tool for illnesses like COPD. And it is that is a population that constantly gets readmitted to hospital on an emergency basis, and therefore, in the words of the unkind, clog up the system. In the words of the kind, they're frequent flyers. I think either of those terms are not necessarily quite how the COPD patient will view themselves. But, you know, if you actually need to monitor people on a daily basis and you're trying to run some kind of dashboard, which is what people call these schemes, I understand. I was very interested in yours, but I mean, it is interesting looking at this because these are the patients you want to monitor all the time. The problem is that most of these schemes only work, and I think this has been a theme of many of the speeches today, if they've actually got a human being doing some interaction with you as well. It's not one or the other. It needs to be both. Therefore, trying to reduce the cost and getting innovation going right is not terribly helpful. In terms of, there is the most basic of all, which has been around for rather a long time, and this is something called the telephone. Persuading members of the general practice persuasion to use the telephone on a regular and ongoing basis to save their time and the time of the people sitting in their waiting room seems to be beyond the capability of our current NHS. There are some wonderful ones who are doing this, I know, but for those of us who are told to wait in for 24 hours for the results of our test because our mobiles don't work, in the flat, so if you're in the flat and if you're outside, you can only give one number. It's all quite irritating. If you wait in for a day, no test results are given. At the end of that day, you receive a letter saying, since you haven't operated under our systems of ringing you up, you now have to come and see a GP, like a sort of punishment. It's quite interesting. You wouldn't have minded seeing one in the first place if somebody had offered it, you know. So it's all quite interesting. And when you get there, great use of technology and innovation is the doctor will frequently be looking at a screen rather than looking at you. And what they don't do is to sort of look at the screen to the effect of seeing why you came in before and why you therefore be coming back. So you get often the question is, yes, how can I help you? You feel like saying, well, I'm here because you've sent for me, you know. I mean, this is rather like going into the staff room at school, isn't it? You know, or doing something like that. Anyway, I think the difficulty is that if you're not going to use the basics of the phone and the internet and the various other things to the greatest, how come other innovations can ever really take hold when those have been around a long time now and people are still so... I don't think it's risk averse. I think they're averse to change. I think people are really, really averse to change, and that's what feels like it's going on. So, in the sort of second kind of question, I can't remember which one it is there. It's about behaviour modification experts. So, I learnt something in trying to deal with this speech about this business about capability, opportunity, and motivation. Awfully glad there were three quick words I could use to try and grasp what was going on. And I'm going to really look at motivation because that to me is the business of how we can get change, which is what innovation is all about. And if we look at most of us, I was going to say this and hoping that the room will be full of people like me who are overweight, over age, over everything, you know, on the way through. Because if you look at this, why is it that the population is not taking any notice of everything that everybody's telling them to do to look after themselves? And the reality is that they don't want to. Sorry, you know, if you told most people in this room that really they shouldn't drink again, how many people would take any notice? universities are not places that indicate that alcohol should be absent, in my experience. And I think that this is something that, you know, it's all very well, you know, do as I say, not as I do, I think is the issue that comes up here. And if we all know we all need to exercise a lot, but actually the reality is, if we all exercise enough, we probably land up needing knee and hip replacements. So, you know, this isn't straightforward, you know, because you don't always do what it is that you should do. And do we know we should do it? Yes. Do we change? No, or only temporarily, is what I would say, is that, you know, we prevaricate, and if we prevaricate, why wouldn't everybody else prevaricate? And I was trying to think what the main motivators are for change, of a sort of fundamental nature like I've got to change. And I think they come down into two words. One is fear and the other is love. You might do it because somebody loves you so much that they kind of force you into it or guilt you into it, or you want to do it for them. But mostly it's fear. And that fear only comes about quite late in the day. Because most people up to a certain age, I certainly was like this, I mean up to the age of 30, I didn't ever think that, you know, getting to 50 would have been an achievement, but it was so out of my idea of what I could think about that I couldn't even think it was possible. And so we all prevaricate, and I think we're equivocal about fear. You know, it's always, it'll come later rather than anything else. And so I think this is a really difficult issue, because if you look at the size of the NHS, you're talking about what, 1.4 million employees? Well, who else ever gets 1.4 million people to do the same thing and change? Nobody. So why do we think it's going to work? I suppose is the question that I would pose on the way through. And I think people want to lead but don't. I think that people want to follow, but don't always. But they do want what other people have. So there's a sort of natural jealousy. You know, if you've got it, I want it. And whether that's money or health or whatever it is. And because they see innovation talked about in the press or research is announced, that often 10 years before it can ever be used, you know, or anything like that. Having worked in one of the member organisations of the MRC in the past, I know that if something in the newspaper says that red wine or chocolate is a good idea, people might follow it. If it says don't, the chances are much, much more remote that they'll do it. But if they will ring up, I don't know if you remember, there was an extraordinary picture once in the newspaper of a mouse with an ear grown on it. It was such an extraordinary sight. And so we had lots of people ringing up saying, well, in that case, could the mouse grow me a lung? So the lack of reality amongst patients as to what innovation can bring is just quite extraordinary. And if you want and have innovation coming into systems, and therefore the expectations are rising, then what you're going to have is a greater demand for healthcare services, because there's more innovation and the thought is that you could do more. And a good example of that, and how it works in a counterintuitive way, is hip replacement. I mean, in the past, you'd have got old, you'd have suffered, and you would have died younger, in a lot of pain. Nowadays, very mercifully, you will probably have a hip replacement. Might not have it as quickly as you'd like. And the interesting thing to me, going back to the Audit Commission days since you mentioned them, is the fact that the Audit Commission many years ago decided to do a report on, as a tracer condition for care for the elderly, on hip operations, and what happened from beginning to end of this. And we went through all kinds of things which were fascinating, but I won't bore you with because you've time constraints. But if you're looking at this, they came at the end and said there's a very shocking fact that I can't remember the percentage, but it was about 50% of all operations are being done with the wrong kind of hip joints. And so I said, well, this is an absolute scandal. This should never be happening. What are we going to do about this? Oh, well, they said, this is fascinating. We'll go back, and every year, for 4 years, we did an audit of who'd changed as a result of this, even though they'd had edicts from the Department of Health and various other places to change. And they came back, the auditors, with pride after 4 years and said to me, isn't it wonderful? Only 22% of hospitals are still using the wrong one. Now imagine my horror when last year I heard a report that said, we've just discovered people are using the wrong hip joints. And that's 20 odd years. And that's really shocking because it's a well-known basic operation. But the people who are doing it haven't necessarily been trained in the new joints, or they didn't know the new joints would fail, or the different things that have come in have caused them to sort of hold back in all of that. The third sort of bit that I was going to try and take a quick skirmish through, because I realise the time, is the role of patient in innovation. And I wanted to say, you know, people do some really fabulous work in this, but they don't always start by saying to a patient, what would you really like to change? They start from saying, I've got an idea that I want to change, now how do I involve you in that idea? And I was sitting there thinking, what was it that was the most important thing that if you asked any patient that they would really immediately like to change if they had to go to hospital and have any kind of tests? And the first thing is that they'd like gowns that did up at the front instead of the back. Okay? Because walking down a corridor with your bottom hanging out is not the most attractive thing to be doing anywhere. Tell me this, does everybody know that? Yes. Does anybody have gowns that do up at the front? Small innovation. Do a lot for your dignity if you were there. And I was very struck by something I did in a local authority in the past, where a housing department spent a lot of money and a lot of time improving its housing department. So it decorated the room that was the waiting room better, it put in better chairs, it put in a vending machine with hot drinks in that people could have for free. And then they had done a sort of before test of how people felt about it and then afterwards. And they were absolutely horrified to find that the afterwards test was no improvement on the first one, because they'd done all these things for people. So they then went back and said, why hasn't it improved? And the people all said, yeah, but that, none of that matters. What matters is that I see the same person I saw last time, and they know about my housing situation. So the very basic things, if you don't ask somebody, you often innovate and do something that somebody doesn't really want. And I think it's much easier to innovate asking healthcare professionals on some of the more technical things, because they have a very good and clear idea of what they want. And I think there's a real issue about how we innovate and do research for children, which I thought you might mention, but you didn't. And so I'm just going to throw it in as my last comment. Because it's often thought not to be ethical to do research on children, no research is mostly done. So, but we give them all medicines, we have operations, we do things, all kinds of things like that happen. We don't actually train GPs very largely in caring for children, yet a large proportion of the population of the people that they see are children. And if you are, as a child, not able to express yourself or to do very much, you're never asked what might be better for you and involved in any kind of innovation. So I'd love somebody to think through that one and come up with something that didn't just say it isn't ethical. Because that's been said, we need a way round that on the way through. And I do think that when you're designing equipment for use by people as in addition to systems, involving people and asking them what it is that they would really like is absolutely a top priority. Because if you've ever tried to be in a wheelchair, for instance, you know there are wheelchairs and wheelchairs, and some are impossible and some really work well. But it's very difficult to know that when you're trying to buy one for somebody who's elderly, because you just want to get them around and you can't find that out. So there you are. I think innovation is a good idea. It's not often seen in the same light by patients, because really what they'd like is just things that are small and basic and make them comfortable to change. And of course they'd like to live forever. Thank you very much.